but I think of it as a potluck nation. And a potluck only works when people contribute. You don't have a potluck if people don't bring an offering. And a potluck is boring if everybody brings the same dish. So what we ought to look for in America is a table that welcomes the contributions of a diversity of people and nurtures a kind of coherence and gestalt.
Welcome to the BJC podcast as we conclude our special series on Christian nationalism. I'm Amanda Tyler, Executive Director of BJC, and your host for this series. For 10 weeks, we've been exploring different aspects of Christian nationalism, hearing the perspectives of religious leaders, academics, historians, a lawmaker, a theologian, and a journalist. We've explored how Christian nationalism intersects with race and white supremacy, and we've examined how the separation of church and state creates room for religion to flourish in our country. I've learned so much from each of my guests, and I'm grateful that they've added their expertise to this topic to increase our understanding of the complicated issue of Christian nationalism. So, where do we go from here? As we conclude, I want to think about a solution, an antidote to Christian nationalism, and that is a full embrace of religious pluralism. I'm thrilled to be joined today by Eboo Patel, someone who understands pluralism and is putting it into action in powerful and effective ways. Eboo is the founder and president of Interfaith Youth Core. IFYC is based in Chicago and works internationally to promote interfaith leadership on college campuses. In his work, he's spoken on more than 150 different college and university campuses. BJC is bringing him to a campus in Dallas, Texas next year for our annual lecture series. We'll be with Eboo on the campus of Southern Methodist University and SMU's Perkins School of Theology on March 4th and 5th. You can join us. Visit the link in our show notes for details. Eboo grew up in Glen Ellyn, Illinois, studied sociology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and has a doctorate in the sociology of religion from Oxford University, where he studied on a Rhodes Scholarship. Eboo was a member of President Barack Obama's inaugural Advisory Council on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. He's written 4 books and dozens of articles, and I'm so glad to have him here today. Eboo, welcome to the BJC podcast.
I am thrilled to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Well, when we were thinking about how we were going to wrap up this series, I wanted to end not only on a hopeful note, but with some direction on a way forward. And I immediately thought about you and your work, and particularly your recent book, Out of Many Faiths, Religious Diversity and the American Promise. And in your book, you say that you set out to answer this question: how do we affirm and extend the ethic that welcoming religiously diverse people, nurturing positive relations among them, and facilitating their contributions to the nation is part of the definition of America? And I think you've written a beautiful book, really a long essay, that addresses that point from your perspective as a Muslim in America. So as we start our conversation today, I'd like to start out with some definitions. I've asked most of the other guests on this series for their definition of Christian nationalism, but for our conversation, I'd love for you to start us off with a definition of what I think is often a misunderstood term, and that is, what is religious pluralism?
Sure. Well, it's terrific to be with you, Amanda. I'm thrilled to be a part of this podcast, and I'm thrilled to be with you all in Dallas, God willing, next March for the series of lectures that you invited me to do. So we begin our definition of religious pluralism here at IFYC from Diana Eck's very important distinction between the terms diversity and pluralism. And Diana Eck highlights that diversity is just a demographic fact. It's just the existence of people with different identities in close proximity. The term diversity does not say anything about how they interact with each other, whether it's cooperation or conflict or some kind of a cold war. Pluralism, on the other hand, is not just a fact, it's an achievement. It's the achievement of positive engagement. And here at IFYC, we actually have a three-part definition of pluralism. Number one is respect for diverse identities. Number two is positive relationships between different communities. And number three is some kind of a commitment to the common good.
That's really helpful. And I think that is nice to distinguish it right off the bat from what it's not, because so many people use diversity and pluralism interchangeably. I found in conversations, there's also some confusion about relativism, or this idea that to be in favor of pluralism is somehow to water down your own faith or your own distinction. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, so that's not the way we use the word pluralism. For us, it's not a theological pluralism. It's not all paths of the mountain lead to the same place kind of view, although that is one view, and it's certainly not one that we're dismissive of. We just say that it is one theological view amongst many theological views. There's a Christian exclusivist view. There's a Muslim exclusivist view, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When we talk about pluralism, it's really a civic pluralism that basically whatever you might think about creation and salvation, when you share civic space with people who have different ideas of creation and salvation, you ought to figure out ways to cooperate. You ought to figure out ways where you can coach Little League together, where you can serve on the PTA together, where you can do heart surgeries in the same hospital together, where you can be good neighbors. And actually, there is a theological dimension to that. We call that the theology of interfaith cooperation, which is to say, you don't have to believe that your neighbor is going to heaven to bring that person a cup of sugar when she or he might need it, right? That all of our religious traditions have a theology of positive cooperation, including with the person who is not part of your religious tradition. So for us, pluralism is a civic term. There is a theological dimension, but the theological dimension is about cooperation, including with those who do not share your theology.
And thanks for setting that frame. So for the rest of our conversation, whenever we say pluralism, we'll be talking about civic pluralism and not talking about religious pluralism versus as distinguished from religious exclusivism. I really loved your book, and there was a lot of history in the book. I think also a lot of conversation about the way that the founders of our constitutional system set up our country. If you could summarize, like, what did America's founders think about pluralism?
Yes, so this is actually a remarkable fact. I think I first read this in Michael Walzer's book, What It Means to Be an American, where he points out that for generations, actually for centuries, political philosophers thought that the only way to have a democratic nation was to have a homogenous population, especially a religiously homogenous population. The idea was basically that one people, which is to say one religious people, all Muslims or all Christians or all Jews, made one state. And the American founders believed differently. And in fact, some of the European settlers on these shores before the founders, Roger Williams was one of them, the authors of the Flushing Remonstrance were others, believed differently as well. They believed that you could have a religiously diverse democracy, which is to say that people coming from the four corners of the earth, praying to God in different ways, including not at all, could come to a patch of land and together build a nation. And you see it over and over again in the writings of George Washington, of John Adams, of James Madison, of Benjamin Franklin, of Thomas Jefferson, this notion that people from other religious backgrounds weren't only to be tolerated, but proactively welcomed. There's this great line in Washington, the bosom of America welcomes the oppressed and persecuted of all peoples and of all nations and religions. When a Jewish leader in the 1790s reached out to George Washington and effectively asked him, you know, what's going to happen to my people in this new nation? Washington writes back in a famous document, frankly, I wish it was more famous, called the Letter to the Hebrew Congregation of Newport, Rhode Island. He writes back, my government will give to bigotry no sanction and to persecution no assistance. Benjamin Franklin makes a donation to the building funds of every religious community with a building in Philadelphia, a variety of Christian sects, a Jewish community. He helps to build a hall in Philadelphia and says the pulpit of this hall will be open to the representative of the Grand Mufti of Constantinople. You know, so this was a set of people who kind of envisioned something that, who built something that other people couldn't even envision, which was a religiously diverse democracy. And a big theme of my book is to say it's not just Roger Williams and the authors of the Flushing Remonstrance in the middle of the 17th century, and it's not just the American founders in the late 18th century, but there's this whole string of American heroes and intellectuals, Abraham Lincoln, Jane Addams, the NCCJ, Martin Luther King Jr., Barack Obama, who all believe in this idea that part of what makes America distinctive is its proactive understanding of itself as a religiously diverse democracy.
I love all of those examples and how you're threading it through time, through the whole American experience. When people sometimes say, I think falsely, that America was founded as a Christian nation, I like to say, no, I think America was founded as a religious liberty nation or a religious freedom nation, one that would be set up for freedom for people of all faiths or people who don't claim a faith tradition. And what's so remarkable, I think, about the founders in particular is that they were working in a time when we had, as far as I can understand and read the history, far less religious diversity than we do now, that they had that foresight, you know, to set that up.
And in fact, a lot of the founders actually name a set of different religions in their writings, and they probably hadn't met people from these religions, but they were literally naming them. They were imagining them as citizens. Roger Williams does the same thing. He names a set of people from different religions, and it's quite likely that he had not met them, hadn't met people, but he was imagining them citizens. And if you think about, by citizen, I mean somebody who contributes positively to a political entity. And if you think about it, most of us operate quite differently. When we think of a stranger, we imagine a monster, right? We don't imagine that person's best qualities or that person's contributions.
Yeah, it is. And I think we can celebrate that contribution and also acknowledging, as we do now, all of the shortcomings that they had as well. But that this, as far as religious diversity went, really is something that we can look back to now and aspire to with our greater diversity in our country. I found one piece of the history really fascinating and I think very helpful, because like so many of these other myths or sayings, it's so entrenched that we go to it without even thinking. And that's the term Judeo-Christian, that our country was founded on Judeo-Christian values. You tell the history that that really is a pretty modern term. Can you talk a little bit about what your research reflected there?
Yes, so this is one of my favorite stories that I've uncovered in the past couple of years, and it actually comes from a great book called Tri-Faith America by a friend of mine named Kevin Schultz, and he basically writes the history of this term. By the way, I will often begin my lectures on college campuses, I might in fact do this at SMU as part of the Sheridan Lecture, by saying, you know, to this group of very bright 19 and 20-year-olds who have been assembled and are earnestly taking notes during my talk, probably because it gives them extra credit in some class they're taking. I say, you know, when the pilgrims arrived on the Eastern Seaboard and they dusted off Plymouth Rock, they saw the words Judeo-Christian nation etched in the stone.
I love that.
You know, I'll see some, you know, kind of squinty-eyed stares as if to say, that's probably not true, but it then raises the interesting question. So if that's not how the term Judeo-Christian came to be, how did it in fact come to be, right? What is the history of this term, given that everything is a history? And the history of this term turns out to be a lot more recent than the early 17th century. It actually comes out of the anti-Semitic, anti-Catholic, and deeply racist 1920s, a time that's frankly quite like ours. It was a time of profound economic shifts from the agrarian economy to the industrial economy, a time of massive wealth being made in some quarters and significant poverty in others, income inequality, you know, cultural shifts with jazz emerging, social shifts with the shift to the cities, et cetera, et cetera. And part of what happens in times of disruption is things that are going wrong get pinned on minority groups. And the KKK, which numbered 3 to 4 million strong during this era, starts targeting Jews and Catholics and Black folks. And of course, these were targets long before the 20s, but the heat really turned up during that decade, and blaming Jews and Catholics and Black folks for the ills that the nation was facing during this disruption. And what happens in the late 1920s, especially after the first Catholic who runs for president on a major party ticket, Al Smith, who runs as a Democrat in 1928, after his campaign is torpedoed with anti-Catholic ugliness, largely directed by the KKK, is a group of responsible American leaders come together. They call themselves the National Conference on Christians and Jews, or the NCCJ. And they basically say, we can't have a nation that excludes the contributions of non-Protestants. We need to shift our understanding of the nation. And so they start sending out trialogue teams, a minister, a priest, and a rabbi to communities and military bases across the country, talking about what Jews and Catholics and Protestants have in common. They, you know, have phrases like the brotherhood of man under the fatherhood of God, which was very popular in an era leading up to war against what was viewed as an atheistic enemy in Nazism. As they were doing this, they realized that part of what they needed to do was to kind of author a new chapter in American religious history, something that was short and catchy and could kind of replace the idea of Protestant nation in the minds of Americans. And so they came up with a term. They literally invented it. And that term is Judeo-Christian. And slowly but surely, it shifts the way Americans view their nation from a Protestant country to one that welcomes the contributions and faith lives of Jews and Catholics. And we now look at Judeo-Christian as somewhat limited. You know, what about the Buddhists and the Baha'is and the Muslims and the Jains and the Hindus and the Sikhs and the atheists? But the way I think about it is that the term did good work for 70 or 80 years. And our challenge now is to author the title of the next chapter, the chapter that comes after Judeo-Christian.
Do you have a label for such, for our next chapter? Have you, is there a term that you would use in place of that term for our present time?
Well, you know, the shorthand that I have right now is Interfaith Nation. And I think of it, to use kind of another early 20th century phrase and to turn it around, I think of it not as a melting pot, right? Which is a phrase that was coined, I think around 1910 or 1915, but I think of it as a potluck nation. And a potluck only works when people contribute. You don't have a potluck if people don't bring an offering, and a potluck is boring if everybody brings the same dish. So what we ought to look for in America is a table that welcomes the contributions of a diversity of people and nurtures a kind of coherence and gestalt, right? The beauty of a potluck is not just all of these dishes on the table. It's the kind of wholeness and banquet that those dishes kind of make happen, the gestalt of it all. And a potluck requires people to take care of the commons, to clean the space, to bring enough plates and cutlery, to make sure that people feel safe, to make sure that the people who don't eat pork, that dishes are properly labeled, that, you know, people with peanut allergies or gluten issues are kept safe. So I love the idea of an interfaith nation that acts more like a potluck supper than a Judeo-Christian nation that is a melting pot.
Great image, and I think a great way for us to think about what works better for the incredibly religiously diverse nation that we have now. You know, this, we're concluding our series on Christian nationalism. This project has been, has run alongside another project called Christians Against Christian Nationalism. And part of that project has meant to push back against what I think is a very damaging idea that to be a true American, one must be Christian. And we certainly can push back against that by pointing to our founding, to our constitutional and other legal protections that are meant to ensure that government stays neutral with regard to religion. But we can also tell stories and tell stories of Americans who are not Christian, who are contributing to our shared life in our civic space. And you do a lot of storytelling in your book. And I wonder if you might share a story or two of some of these Americans who aren't Christians and what they've done for our country.
Yeah. You know, so I was in Grand Rapids a few weeks ago, and there's a world-class medical facility there. I met a guy named Dr. Ali, who is a child cancer specialist. And he told me a story about a family who, you know, whose child had a rare form of cancer that Dr. Ali happens to be a specialist in. And Dr. Ali was preparing a treatment plan and overhears one of the parents say something about, you know, all these Muslims that are now in our country should just get out. It was, you know, I don't know if this person was talking to a family member on the phone, but in any case, Dr. Ali overhears this and he kind of says, "Riley, would you like me to get out of this country before or after I treat your daughter?"
Yeah.
And, you know, I write in the book Out of Many Fates about high profile Muslims who've made obvious contributions to America, people like Muhammad Ali, people like Khizr Khan. But there's a reasonable chance that there is a Muslim in your life, your doctor, the person that you buy your groceries from, your accountant, maybe your tennis partner, who contributes to your life personally, right? And you probably wouldn't want a nation without that person or a neighborhood without that person. And America is America because we welcome the contributions of people from a range of backgrounds in both big and small ways.
Your book goes a lot, and I think this goes to that comment that was made towards Dr. Ali or in his presence, and to this idea of anti-Muslim bias or Islamophobia, as some people call it. Can you talk some to what those biggest threats to pluralism are and to this idea of our interfaith nation?
Sure. So, you know, one of the things that I write a lot about is how contemporary anti-Muslim bias feels a lot like late 19th and early 20th century anti-Catholic bias. So the great historian Arthur Schlesinger once famously said that anti-Catholic bias is the deepest bias in the American people. There's obviously a lot of communities in America, African-Americans, Native Americans, who have a claim to that, you know, throne, so to speak, of communities that have faced the most bigotry. But the fact that a historian of Schlesinger's kind of stature would say Catholics are in that category should give us pause, right? Because if you think about this for a second, think about how much of our civil society has been contributed by Catholics. The 230 colleges and universities, for example, thousands and thousands of elementary schools and high schools, hundreds and hundreds of hospitals. And think for a moment that there were organized civil society movements, the Know Nothing Party, the KKK, which viewed all of these Catholic institutions, which enrich American life in extremely concrete ways, right? Like they teach kids how to read and they help people deal with their addictions and they save lives in hospitals. All of these civic contributions might have been excluded if the KKK and the Know Nothing Party had won. The Know Nothing Party of the 1850s was no small party. I mean, they elected 75 people to Congress in one of the elections of the early 1850s. So anti-Muslim bias feels a lot like that right now, which is, you know, this idea that any Muslim institution, school or social service agency or mosque, is a Trojan horse with Muslim extremism living in it. That's literally what people would say about Catholic institutions like schools and hospitals 100 years ago. So I think exclusion and racism is a major threat to pluralism, not only because it is a violation of the dignity of a particular group of people, but also because it is a barrier to their contribution.
So, as I said, I wanted to end this series about what can we do about this. And I think one thing that people are doing, Christians in particular are doing, are signing the Christians Against Christian Nationalism statement as a way to stand up for their faith, but also for the equal citizenship and dignity of every American, regardless of their faith tradition. What ideas do you have on what people can do to help further this ethic of religious pluralism, to help invite people to the American potluck?
Sure. I have lots of ideas. Some are about what you can learn, right? One is to learn some inspiring things from American history about America as a religiously diverse democracy. I hope that my book, Out of Many Faiths, can be helpful along these lines. But you know, before I learned the history of the term Judeo-Christian nation, or read about the founders and their approach to religious diversity, I frankly had no idea about it. So I think that these things are really inspiring. It is a great history that we are now writing the next chapter in. So learning something about the history of America as a religiously diverse democracy, I think, is really important. Pay attention to the theology of interfaith cooperation in your own religion. The Good Samaritan story is a great example of a Christian case of a theology of interfaith cooperation, right? I'll simply tease it by saying, think about the question, who were the Samaritans? And think about the lessons of that story. And I would say, learn things that you appreciate and admire about other religious communities. Not things you necessarily agree with, right? But things you appreciate or admire. So for example, in Islam, the focus on mercy and hospitality, I think, is something to be appreciated and admired. So those are the three things I would say you could spend some time learning about. And then I would say, whatever kind of community you're involved in, try to organize concrete interfaith projects, mosque church service partnerships, an exchange of preachers between a synagogue and a church. You know, try to engage in civic partnerships with people from diverse faith communities.
Great. You've given us a lot to think about, a lot to study, a lot to do. And I really do recommend Out of Many Faiths as a great primer, and not to mention, like I said, a lot of wonderful storytelling. Thank you for all that you're doing, too, with Interfaith Youth Corps, and for inspiring young people to get involved when they're in college in interfaith partnerships. And thank you for joining us on the BJC podcast. It's been great to talk with you.
It's been terrific being with you, Amanda. Thank you so much.
And with that, we've reached the end of our special podcast series on Christian nationalism. For the past 10 weeks, we've worked to examine this insidious ideology from a number of different angles. And I hope this series helps you engage in conversations about it with others. We at BJC don't claim to have all the answers. But if we can help raise some helpful and humble questions and provide opportunities for civil dialogue, we might be able to make some headway in pushing back against Christian nationalism. We all have a role to play in building what Ibu just called a potluck nation, where everyone has a seat at the table and brings their unique contributions to the feast. If you haven't read the statement at ChristiansAgainstChristianNationalism.org, I hope you will. And look at the diversity of signers. People from Christian traditions across the theological spectrum are signing the statement. They want to go on record that they are concerned about the threats posed by Christian nationalism. I hope you'll look at the statement and perhaps join them. If you're new to this series, I encourage you to check out the previous episodes and share them with others. We have a playlist of this series on SoundCloud, and the BJC podcast is also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, and wherever you listen. Please subscribe to the BJC podcast for future episodes, and take a moment to leave us a 5-star rating and to write a review. It helps us share these conversations with others. Be sure to follow BJC on social media and let us know what you think of the podcast. We're on Twitter and Instagram at BJC on the Hill, And you can follow me on Twitter at AmandaTylerBJC. And I encourage you to take a moment to learn more about BJC. Visit our website at bjconline.org to see how we work for faith freedom for all. I hope you'll join us to make a difference. Thank you for joining us for this series. I look forward to continuing the conversation with you.